at the heart of both spiritual practice and healing practice. And of course, then, part of the proposition here is that those are the same thing, or they're on a spectrum with each other. They're related intimately. Maybe spiritual practice or liberation practice just means you start healing, you keep healing, you heal all the way, and if when there's no more healing to be done, you're done. Like, that's one idea out there in the yogic world. But even if we think of them as separate, and it's useful sometimes to think of them as separate. Sometimes it feels like the things I call healing are like, can I deal with the really bad stuff that happened to me to bring myself up to something like a what I pretend is sort of the functional baseline, right? Like, I'm not miserable, I'm fine, right? I've healed, I'm fine. And then past that, it might be like, oh, I actually want to get liberated or find bliss or transcendence or deeper integration or integrity. And from there, I go from wellness further. And I'm using the vertical gestures as a metaphor, but of course, you could say the same thing of like, I was really lost, I got grounded, and then I wanted to go deeper. And the metaphor works in both directions. Historically, men preferred the vertical, and women preferred the inverts. At least men's mythology proposed that those were the gendered propositions. We don't actually know what women's mythology proposed, mostly because the men wrote most of the books. It's starting to change. But the metaphor works in both directions. As we start to think about practice, then, in relation to healing, we can think about both what feels like it functions well or works well or is integrated in us, and what feels like it is dysfunctional or doesn't work well or is not integrated. And I want to start with a basic function that we seem to possess as animals. At the heart of working with trauma, and maybe the heart of working with anything, of course, is this, the basic thesis of this course, is that you're an animal, which you may have forgotten, because you spend far too much time, you know, like, indoors, clothed, engaging with screens rather than objects. You might not know that many animals relative to if you were an animal in the wild and you were around a lot of animals. Human cultures have done so much that is unique to being human that we forget sometimes that we are just beings among many, and we're animals, particularly among many. And what that means is that our bodily experience does some things instinctually, kind of by itself, that are similar to kind of all of our relatives in the animal world. And one of the simplest ways we can begin with that is to talk about a system in us and a pattern of activity that we can call approach-avoid, the approach-avoid system. And approach-avoid is a way of saying that without needing to think about anything or have any sort of complex ideas about something, our body and feeling self, and now like, okay, we're going to start separating body and mind. There's no separation really. So we can say the body thinks or feels. An attraction to or is drawn to things that are in some way feel safe, pleasant, interesting. Tell me if ever my writing gets too messy for you. Nourishing, connecting, right? We're social creatures. We live generally in packs. We're not. We're more like dogs than cats, generally. And so we approach, you know, these things. We approach, you know, we approach food. We approach people as prospective mates sometimes, etc. And really the heart of these, I'll say, is the first two. This the perception of safety and pleasure. We really like things that are safe, that feel safe, and we really like things that feel pleasurable. Bless you. And then its contrary, this is the first of the polarities, is avoid. So as animals, we tend to avoid things that that feel like danger, that are unpleasant or painful. We tend to avoid things that are uninteresting in a particular way. We often don't notice them in a certain way. So, you know, there's a kind of the opposite of interesting all the way would be like not even like actively disinterested, because there's some interest if it's something frightening. It's more like dull, you know, or numb in a way. The opposite of nourishment would be like poison, you know, harmful. And the opposite of connection would be isolation. So in general, right, a bunch of what I'll call spectra. And I'll use this word a lot this weekend. Basically, every time we start to investigate an aspect of our experience, we can analyze it or start to think about it in terms of its being on a spectrum in some way. So like, if I have this quality that's beloved in the contemplative systems that I might call being present. What does it mean to be present? You know, here's a couple of definitions. We could define it lots of ways. One way I'll say is that my cognitive and conscious attention is with my physical sensory experience rather than being primarily with image or thought that has as its object sensory experiences that are not happening right now. That's a complex way of saying, if I'm thinking about yesterday's lunch, I'm less present with the sensations of my body, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, in this moment. The thought is still happening in this moment. You're never not present, right? Like, it's not like you can actually be in yesterday's lunch. But we use the word present as a way to talk about where my attention is. So that's a quality that's beloved in contemplative practice. It's tremendously useful. It's probably the basis of all of the yogic type of practices, anyway. And we can then think of it in terms of, oh, it's on a spectrum. And that spectrum has to do with attention, being intimate with or contactful or close to the senses, the physical senses, right? And so then, you know, the opposite of presence in a certain way is presence then, where we could say, oh, we'll use as a synonym for like embodiment, right? That my connection with my senses in the present is how I feel like I'm with my body. If I'm disconnected from my senses, it's what we start to call disembodied or dissociated, you know. The beautiful line from, you know, the beginning of one of the stories, and I think it's James Joyce's Dubliners, Mr. Duffy lived a short distance from his body.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And of course, you know, it's James Joyce, so I picture a kind of dour Irish man in a top coat and a hat kind of clomping sullenly along a rainy Dublin street. The body's there, and his spirit is just kind of a little bit out, you know. And you might know that experience. Right? My heart is warm for Mr. Duffy. I've been Mr. Duffy. Lots. Right? Why is Mr. Duffy living a short distance from his body? Because it's painful. Mm. Right? His approach avoid system is saying, go toward what's safer and more pleasant. So this is a model that says, this is, first of all, and almost everything we're going to talk about this weekend is what we'll call in nervous system language autonomic, meaning it's not under conscious control. you don't decide to be present or not. Ooh, the black is gone.
You don't decide to be present or not. It happens based on conditions.
And so your nervous system, which is really the part of you we're talking about here, if you had to think about these things, you'd be dead, right? Like, if you had to, you're walking into the crosswalk, the bus driver doesn't see you, you hear the flash of brakes, and if you had to go, brakes are screeching, and I see a fast shape out of the corner of my left eye. Oh, I think this means the bus is about to hit me. What should I do? Should I walk backwards? Should I try to jump straight up? Maybe I should try to duck. Like, you can't think through it, right? What you do, way before you even perhaps notice it's there, is your body jumps, yeah? If you're healthy, it jumps. And this is one of the ways that trauma kills folks, right? It can land. Mr. Duffy is actually in quite a bit of danger, right? You know, Mr. Duffy is in danger of it being an image of a man in a bowler from the early 20th century. He's in danger of, you know, a piano falling from a rooftop or something that, you know, might happen. He's in danger of the bus hitting him because he's not in his body. And so his autonomic nervous system is out of whack. So all of this stuff is autonomic. You don't do it on purpose. And think about now that little exercise we did. We talked a whole bunch. You heard a bunch from everybody. And you let your eyes go around the room, so you're sensing the space. A few things happen automatically when we do that. One is that you have a felt sense of where you are in the room, what the room is, who's here, and the animal part of you is tracking a bunch of things in that. Where are the doors, and how close are you to them? If somebody in here was suddenly dangerous, where would you go, right? Do you feel safe in yoga studios? Is this a space where you kind of let down and your full self? Or are you like, this isn't quite my space, right? That's an autonomic experience. You don't have to think about that. That happens by itself. These are all, we could say, reactivities. Often when we say reactivity nowadays, it comes with a little pejorative, you know, oh, you're so reactive, right? As if you should somehow, like, not be. And I'm like, the non-reactive person is a corpse. You know, what that feedback really means is you're too reactive. And what we'll say is, more precisely in relation to trauma, you're reacting to things that are not actually here. And this is going to be core to our definition of trauma. So here's the approach of void system. In the early Buddhist system, this is given a particular name. And that word is vedana. And it means, it translates as feeling tone, which is an awkward translation. I like the translation affect, which is a kind of technical word from the study of emotion in psychology. Affect is like the basic hit of force or charge that comes before the complex emotion. And vedana is the term in the Buddhist system that's used to refer simply to the feeling of something being pleasant. I'll now just use plus and minus, or unpleasant. And I'm generally going to use blue for pleasant, safe, interesting, nourishing, connecting, what I want, and red for what I don't want, unsafe, and that. It's core to this whole system that what we are not trying to construct your life so that you only have blue and you have no more reds. Impossible. Yes, sir.
I think both of us had a question.
Yeah.
Just a real clarification. When you say affect, I'm interpreting that as like your first reaction of how you're affected based on this.
That's not the technical definition of affect, but that is functionally how it happens.
So what do you mean by affect?
Affect is an emotion term in psychology that refers to the basic structure of emotions. If we think about, like, what's an emotion? It's like, oh, I'm mad. What does that mean? You know, what it probably means is there's an uncomfortable or charged physical experience, vibration, tension, constriction, heat, whatever, muscular engagement. We'll talk about all this soon. And there's going to be a story.
Yeah.
I don't like what they did.
Right.
You know.
And something I want to either approach or avoid.
Something I want, I'm approaching or avoiding. The term anger is a pretty complex term because it's referring to this web that has both physiology and charge and story. So then we use this word emotion to refer to that whole thing. Mm-hmm. Affect is, like you said, it's just the first hit. It's the like, mm-hmm. you know. And affect is just like, oh, that's unpleasant.
Yeah.
The place that this goes, and this is the root of suffering in the yogic systems, our habit is to want the pleasant and to
right.
not to fear or not want the unpleasant.
Right.
And from the very, very beginning of yoga in the Upanishads, you know, 500 to 700 BC, the very first text to use the word yoga to refer to a systematic body of practice, says this. This is the Katha Upanishad. So the Katha Upanishad is a dialogue between a seeker named Nachiketas and the Lord of Death, his guru. And in the Katha, the core teaching in yoga goes something like this. In the cave of the heart, there are two beings. One drinks of the sweet and bitter stuff, preferring the sweet, disliking the bitter. That one lives in darkness. The other drinks of the sweet and bitter, neither preferring the sweet nor rejecting the bitter. That one lives in light. Mm. It's the very first teaching in yoga. So this is a teaching to deal with your preferences, basically. It says, if you're really caught up in liking the pleasant and disliking the unpleasant, and the implication is reactivity, like really running your life based on that, basically running toward the pleasant and running away from danger, the unpleasant, you're trapped. And this is an interesting rub with your basic physiology, because this is natural. This is what animals do. You get chased, you run, right? You know, someone attractive comes along, you sniff, you turn their way, you get hay. Right? Like, that's how you work as an animal. And that gets all sorts of tangled up with culture, but that's the physiology. So it's very interesting that yoga comes along and says, unwrap that. Do something different with that. And you might be like, why? And the Buddha will come in and say, because to continue to go with that always keeps you on the round of suffering. And this is embedded in the ancient concept of karma and reincarnation. Basically, if you keep wanting things and fearing things, you will keep wanting things and fearing things for time immemorial. And the Buddha says, you know, when I looked back and saw all of my previous lives, born here, died there, did this, did that, suffered in this way, got this, lost this, I realized that the amount of tears that I had shed, suffering and grieving in all of those lifetimes, was greater than the water in all the seven great oceans. This is the vision of eternal return in the early yogic system, that it's painful. Which doesn't mean it's not awesome, also. There's both. But those sages said, both in the Buddhist and Hindu systems, it's not... There's the realm of being in it, where the natural thing to do is to increase the pleasant, decrease the unpleasant, but you can never guarantee that, and so you're always in motion. The only other thing to do is to let go from the whole system. And the mystery of yoga from the very beginning is that when you do that, you don't die. You get these sages, these people, men and women, thousands of them over the centuries, who do this. I don't know if do is the right verb. Something happens where this system gets snapped open. And there arises these states that are called like equanimity or balance or clarity or peace, shanti, where the resistance to the painful and the grasping at the pleasant has dissolved by the force of something else. And so then the Vedanta people will call it God, the Buddhists will call it not God, it doesn't matter. It happens. And if it wasn't the case that that experience was incredible, these would not be living systems. This would have been like a brief flare-up of a nihilistic philosophy and it would have disappeared. Right? If that's all it was, if it was just like let go of life and you disappear into the void, that's not a system that survives for 3,000 years with inspired people giving their entire life's energy to doing something. So there's something in that. Even if we've come through tantra and all sorts of complexity and we are not those ascetic practitioners in the forest, the very beginning of practice and healing is that you have to deal with this. Deal with your approach avoid system, with pleasant and unpleasant. So, Buddhist term, vedana, to refer to that. So, what happens then? Yes.
Vedana is referring to before the story?
Yeah.
The incident?
Yep.
Okay.
So, here's kind of the basic diagram. This is a diagram that I'll sometimes do in when we're talking about like Patanjali's yoga system or early Buddhist systems. A brief version of this. This is a really, really simplified version of what. This is a simplified cycle taken from what in the Buddhist tradition is called dependent origination or codependent arising. Don't worry about that, but there you go. Stuff happens constantly, if you hadn't noticed. And so that stuff happens. It's sensory input, right? I see you, I smell this, I hear this sound, I have a sensation. That's all that happens, by the way, right? It's just sensory input. Some of it is unpleasant, and some of it is pleasant. And in relation to the pleasant and unpleasant, a couple things can happen. Either we can react to them based in habit. The habit is to grasp the pleasant and to resist the unpleasant. And when that happens, we land in states that are themselves painful. States like grasping, fearing, hatred, or numbness, shutting down, collapse. Right? For a number of reasons that we'll talk about in a minute. When we're stuck with those things, this is the natural result. It can't help but happen. When that happens, it changes our state, right? We're affected by those feelings that are happening. That cycles around to our actions. Right? We do something in relation to that. We run away from the unpleasant, we move toward the pleasant, etc. Actions combine with the previous conditions. Conditions came from whatever else was already happening. Conditions and actions combine together to be my state. Conditions and actions, and here I am. And from my state, pleasant and unpleasant things happen, and onward around the circle. This entire cycle, stuff happens, I react, I enter constricted mind states, heart states, emotional states based on it. My actions are colored by those and therefore keep that cycle going. This is called dukkha or suffering. There's dukkha in the Pali, the early Buddhist spelling, because that's my primary lineage for the yoga people here. stop me before I do too much Sanskrit, but there's the Sanskrit. And there's the Pali. It literally just means pain. And I like the translation unsatisfying. Satisfying. And it's also just translated as stress. This is stressful. It's stressful. Basically, you're fighting against reality. Because you can't prevent the unpleasant. And you can't preserve the pleasant. Right? I know you're trying. Valiantly. But it's not working. Things are going to keep unfolding that way. So there's another way. And the other way is habit, right? Here's the spectrum. Habit is like unconscious action. So conscious action, rather than habit, is more like choice, basically. Like you have agency, rather than running on autopilot. And instead of reactivity, where you're just responding, you actually, or instead of reactivity, where you're just like having a reflex in a way, you get to then respond. And respond has, they're often used together. Reactive is like when it's happening out of my control, and respond is like my intention, my values, my presence is behind it. And the main thing that makes them different is that in the dukkha one, you were essentially unconscious. And so we'll put not mindful or not aware. Let's use awareness right now. Based in not being aware of it, this cycle. Over here, you're aware of it. Right, so there's mindfulness, there's non-mindfulness. What happens when I'm aware of the pleasant and unpleasant, and I get to make choices and respond wisely in relation to them, is that I get to actually practice. And when I practice, what I'm practicing is being mature, basically, in relation to my experience. Right? Something painful is happening, and I understand it in a certain way. You know, I'm like, oh, you know, I have a little headache, I stayed up late last night. It's okay, you know. If I'm reactive, I'm just like, damn it, I have a headache again. Who has some ibuprofen? I hate this. I totally, God, I can't believe I'm here. Maybe I should, you know, I should really just change my diet. I don't know. I'm just like, my life is a mess. That's reactive, right? Non-reactive is like, oh, look, I have a headache. Even if all those things are true, and it might be like, I have a headache, and if I really reflect on the choices I'm making in my life, I could tune things up a bit, you know? That's very different. It's very different in terms of the affect and the emotion and the constriction, really, in the heart that's there. So the opposite of grasping is acceptance, basically. Now, remember that acceptance doesn't mean agreeing with or, you know, acceptance doesn't mean like you're cool with it happening. Like I know about systemic sexism and racism. I accept that they exist. In other words, I'm not in denial. I don't like them. I don't want them. I want to change them. There's nothing about them that I concur with. But I'm honest about their existence. That's acceptance. Acceptance doesn't mean like, this is cool. I'm not going to reach in and do anything about this because it's cool. That's not what acceptance means here. Acceptance is simply the opposite of grasping. The opposite of fear, fearing something. Maybe I want to say love. That's a little bit more juicy than the Buddhist system tends to go to. With this, they would tend to go more toward a sort of equanimity way. So the opposite of fear and hatred will be... if I'm really not afraid of something, I don't necessarily love it, right? But I'm, what's the good word? I'm unbound is really what I kind of want to say in relation to it. I'm open in its presence. I'm unguarded. Okay. Maybe vulnerable is an interesting opposite. I don't necessarily love it, but I'm here.
Equal.
equal is really interesting because part of what we do in here is we're judging and comparing all the time. You know, I'm going to go with something like unguarded, or let's say vulnerable. It's such a nice word. So vulnerable. And vulnerable is really poignant because, of course, I can totally be harmed. Like, you could totally hurt me. And that's just true, right? So, like, oh, I don't have to love you. But if I stop fearing you, there's actually a way that my tender self comes forward. And then we're in a very different state, you know. And it's intimate also in a beautiful way. The opposite of hatred is love, of course. Right? There's more the pointed thing. And the opposite of shutdown would be like presence. You know, or if shutdown is the constriction of energy, the awakening of energy, I'll call it vitality, which is very nice. So vitality, aliveness. All of this is just the result of awareness. This is why all the early classical yoga systems are awareness systems. They're all like, pay attention, pay attention, pay attention. You know. When I pay attention, I have choices, I respond, and I'm cultivating these beautiful, the old language would be virtues, really. The cycle then is that these things are what affect my actions. Let me draw it again. These things affect my actions. And actions combine with conditions, and it changes my state. And it is from my state that I respond to the next moment. So there's the cycle. And if you want to, for the scholars in the room, if you want to look it up, this is a very simple version of the Buddhist teaching called dependent origination, which is not the same map. This is a kind of very action-oriented map, but it's a translation of that thing. So, all of this then suggests that, first of all, our state, our relative state, is tremendously important. It's almost the most important thing in our yogic practice, in our healing practice. And we'll talk a lot about state in just a moment. But this is a practice. And because this habit over here, it's habit for reason, it's tremendously strong. This system is so baked in that that there's a term in it now in psychology. I'll just leave the top ones up there as the kind of archetype of this thing. Ooh, the blue doesn't erase as well. It's kind of good, sort of, metaphorically. Yeah, I like it. We'll use the term negativity bias. Negativity bias is a term that essentially says this. If you are an animal in an unpredictable setting, there's stimulus happening all the time. Some things are pleasant, some things are unpleasant. But the main thing that you're trying to discern as a nervous system, I'm now saying you, I don't know what you means in relation to the autonomic nervous system, because it happens to go on even when my sense of self is absent, so who knows what it is. But your entity, your animal self, prefers pleasure to pain, partly because pain is threatening to life. And does anyone, any of the yoga teachers in here, this is not a test, but do you remember the fifth of the yama? It's not the fifth of the yama. Aparigraha, non-grasping, is the fifth of the yama. It's the fifth of the chittavritti. My apologies. So the five chittavritti are, you know, correct perception, misperception, sleep, memory, and clinging to life. Mm-hmm. Clinging to life. Abhinivesha. And the verse in Patanjali says, clinging to life is deep and instinctive even for the wise. So here's your nervous system. And it seems like, as animals, the basic thing that your animal being wants is to stay alive. Yeah? And then that translates into a million things. You know, you want to you want to procreate, perhaps, you know, or not. Maybe culture has trained you not to want to, maybe with good reason. But some part of the animal biology is oriented toward that. And so what if all of this is actually just based in a very simple preference for aliveness? And what are the implications of that in, like, a cosmic sense? The metaphysics of this are interesting, mm-hmm. right? Why would that which is alive prefer aliveness? In other words, why isn't it just an oscillating system where life and death just come and go? It is that. Haha, that's the secret. That's the absolute view. That is what it is. But there is this preference. Yeah? And so it's very interesting for the early yogis to say, uproot that preference. Right? Uproot the preference to be alive. And then see what happens while you're still alive. This becomes you know, terms like you know, jivan mukta, liberation while living. And, you know, and the folks who really go there, they describe themselves very strangely. You know, the Buddha's term for himself, he didn't call himself Gautama, which was his old layperson's name, and he didn't call himself the Buddha, which that showed up later on. He called himself Tathagata, which is a term that means that which is thus gone. The thus gone. What does that mean? You know. And it's not random that a lot of sages in lots of different cultures refer to themselves in the third person. What happens if you unbind preference in that way? Even the preference, you actually disappear. Don't worry, you're not going to disappear. But that part of you that was clinging is gone. What would that even feel like? So many practitioners nowadays will actually even say, I don't want that. Why would you want that? It sounds like death. And the only thing one can say from a faith perspective within the yoga traditions is it's not death. And you can't know what it's like because you've never known it. The beginning of that incredible David Foster Wallace graduation speech that was turned into a really beautiful video, and rest in peace, David Foster Wallace, one of our tormented sages. But the beginning of it, he tells a story. He says, there's a couple of fish swimming along in the ocean, and they're just chatting about this and that, talking about stuff. And this bigger, older fish swims by, and the older fish says, hey guys, how's the water? And he swims off. There's a pause. And the one little fish says to the other one, what's water? Right? Like, what does it even feel like? But then you get a glimpse of it, right? You get a moment where something drops away. You get it in formal practice, you get it when your child's born or someone dies or who knows, you know. So negativity bias is the personality quality or the habit that arises when, based in this basic physiology, we develop the pattern of only paying attention to what's wrong. If what's wrong is a hint that there would be threat, why would you turn your attention away from it? But, and this is the hinge of all of our trauma healing practice, the vast majority of the time for many, many folks is that the threat that is being perceived is not actual in the moment. It doesn't mean there is no threat, but it means that the thing that I'm reacting to is not what I would call, like, a, you know, use Tom Clancy's phrase, a clear and present danger, mm-hmm. right? So, for instance, I could feel uncomfortable in this room because yoga studios are expensive and I have class kind of shame, anger, etc. I could feel uncomfortable because I'm queer and yoga studios are pretty straight places. I might be in a space where I'm the only mixed race person. You know, who knows, right? all of those are real threats. Like, we understand that the system is violent against folks who are, in lots of ways, not white and male and wealthy. But in this actual moment, I'm not under direct threat. And that's true, even if one of you is like, I don't like this guy. I could be picking it up subtly, but I'm not under actual threat. What I'm under is the momentum of trauma. Trauma, in a way, is my experience in the present that is based in the long historical conditions of danger. So then my approach avoid system is triggered. You know, the way you're looking at me makes me a little something. I don't even know what it is, right? But because it could be dangerous, I can't take my eyes off it. This becomes anxiety. This is anxiety, depression, and shutdown, the great demons in the nervous system. So if this is the case, try this. Once more, let your eyes go around the space, see where you are. And this time, as they wander around, notice the way, you can feel it a little bit, notice the way that your eyes kind of just land on things that are pleasant or interesting to you. They're drawn to something, a tone of light or a color or an object or a person. When your eyes naturally land someplace, notice what it is and hang out there for a moment and see if you can perceive how your state, your physiology is responding to that contact. And moving toward it in some way. And particularly if your eyes find something and you can discern what it is that's interesting, compelling about that, and what's pleasurable in it. And then sensing the pleasurable there, recognizing it, don't do anything with it, you don't have to amplify it or massage it into being, just hanging out. And the next step is to just see if that registers in your body. I really like the color of the wall, the nice colored walls. I hang out with it for a while, and I can just barely discern the way that that sensory input, like some part of me goes, and I can feel how my physiology just kind of goes. Yeah? Letting that go. So the approach avoid system, negativity bias, and the way that our habitual response to perception changes our state leads to really the first intervention, or the first practice, which is to turn my attention toward the pleasurable. This isn't an affirmation. This isn't trying to invoke the pleasurable when it's not there. This is actually to wake up to what feels safe, easeful, less painful in the present moment, and encourage, and in the beginning it takes a little doing, encourage my attention to turn toward that and away from that little nagging sense that something is wrong. Mm-hmm. So we turn toward the pleasant.
And yet it's a paradox of no preference and turning toward.
No preference is the ultimate state. Mm-hmm. Turning toward is the healing process. It's a little bit like, you know, we might have the ideal to have a society that is race blind, let's say, but we don't. We're far from it. So then, it turns out that mixing the people up helps that. Therefore, affirmative action, right? This is a direct legal parallel. Right? Get more people of diverse forms together, even if that means biasing toward one.
Yeah.
Right? It's bias. It's medicinal. Right? That medicinal bias is what's necessary to bring the system back toward homeostasis, toward non-preference. Right? You get a whole mess of white people together now. How many of them are really, really like, ooh, I don't know, there's a couple Irish people here. Not so much anymore. But 100 years ago? Totally. Right? Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, we're all white, but they're Catholic. Bad news. Right? But those people mixed and mingled and had sex and had babies and pretty much, it's not a thing. Except in a few neighborhoods in Boston. You know, it's a couple spots you could go. But mostly, it's not a thing. Right? So, affirmative action works, but it's painful while it happens. This is almost the same principle as, you know, so many of our great medicinals for the body are actually poisonous. Right? You take something, it's actually harmful, you know, but it's gonna move the system. So then, this is a practice that moves us toward balance, which is to favor the pleasant. For a while, until we get better at doing that, basically, until we get good at it. This depends on a couple things. One of the things it depends on is enough relative safety to know with some confidence that your threat detection system is actually behaving in a traumatized way rather than in a realistic, appropriate way. Mm-hmm. In other words, this is not a practice to do. Let's say, if you're a person of an oppressed group, when you're in a very dangerous situation where you're actually being threatened, that's the moment where your approach avoid system is appropriate. So, like, I'll take it out of the social dynamic and I'll go into the woods and I'll say I'm hiking in Denali National Park in Alaska and one of the people I'm hiking with goes, bear. And I go, bear. Even though I've been hiking along going, hey bears, hey bears, this is what you're supposed to do. You know, I'm kind of a Zen hiker. I prefer being super quiet, but then, of course, bears. So, like, bear. And my system does what it's supposed to do, which is I freeze, I look, I assess, and then I do something, right? I run, I climb a tree, I say, hey bears, this is cool, you know? And if I escape, that's good. So the approach avoid system is the appropriate system when there's actual threat. And by actual, I'll mean physical and present moment. So like systemic threat is really hard in relation to trauma because it's always there, but it's not always actual. This is partly why like affinity groups are so important, right? If you're part of an oppressed group, get together with the people who are in your group, right? If you're trying to unbind patriarchy and misogyny, get together with a bunch of not men, you know, and talk about your experience. If you're trying to unbind, you know, your experience being subject to racial bias, get together with people of your color or group. So that enough safety is present, even though the systemic danger is still there. You have enough safety basically to be able to relax. And a lot of this really just comes down to, can you relax in this moment? Yeah.
So this seems like it's really focused on physical safety first, even if psychological safety is still in question. Like it helps to...
It's the same model in both. Mm-hmm. Psychological safety is harder to attain in a certain way.
Especially if you're feeling traumatized or...
Right. And trauma often plays out as physiological symptoms that it could get interpreted psychologically or emotionally. Right? So like I say, oh, I'm vigilant or anxious as my trauma symptom. What's actually happening? What's happening is like with vigilance, there's a kind of tension in my body that's painful. You know, but then I'm like, oh, I'm vigilant. With anxiety, there's a kind of runningness or a sort of speedy energy that doesn't land.
Mm-hmm.
It's painful. Part of the doorway to healing is to come toward the bodily sensation. But we can't do that until we feel safe in relation to who we're with. So then here's another spectrum to bring in, which is the internal-external. Right, here's a basic meditation instruction. Here's a basic trauma-insensitive meditation instruction. Take a comfortable posture, sit up tall, close your eyes, and allow your attention to drop inward into your body, present with the deep space of yourself, letting go of everything else outside. This is a great instruction. I did this instruction for years. I've given that instruction countless times. But what are the prerequisites for that instruction working?
That you could actually sit down, go within.
That you can sit down, that you can go within.
That you can hold still.
That you can hold still.
That you're not already triggered.
That you're not triggered. Uh-huh. Like...
That you've eaten, that you've slept.
All that.
That you're not in physical pain.
Right. And in relation to the social, like, if I'm scared of you, I can't close my eyes and be comfortable. Right? If I'm in a group of people that feels hostile to me, I'm not going to go... Unless I've learned to do that in the shutdown style, right? Which meditators are very fond of, you know? If you like shutdown as your primary defense mechanism, you're going to love Buddhist meditation, you know? Come to our place for a month. We're going to feed you. Don't look at anybody. Don't touch anybody. Keep your eyes down and go inward the whole time. And we'll check in with you once every 2 or 3 days for 15 minutes, right? Antisocial, shutdown-oriented, traumatized people. Hi, my name is John. And that, love it, right? I used to go on 1 and 2 month and 3 month meditation retreat, and the greatest bliss was like, oh my God, like nobody is going to talk to me or get near me or bug me for the entire month. Like, and it didn't even matter that I sucked as a meditator and my mind was a mess and I was anxious and a million, it didn't matter. Because that space of quiet was enough. But I wasn't actually healthy. And I wasn't getting very far in meditation because I wasn't dropping in. You know. So the prerequisites, mostly first section of the first day, I'm going to do the punchline of the whole weekend. Every instruction in yogic practice has prerequisites. And most of them have prerequisites that are very necessary for folks with trauma. In other words, all the instructions that you ever heard that are beginner instructions, they are intermediate instructions. And in some of the more classical traditions, the beginner instructions are advanced instructions. I have meditation manuals that are like 300 pages long, where in the first 10 pages it says, focus on the breath until your mind gets completely stabilized, a white light appears and fills your consciousness, and where there's absolutely no distraction, the perception of the body as separate dissolves entirely into a field of absolutely focused clarity and solidity and continuity that you could maintain for hours without fluctuating. That's step one. And once you do that, now there's a lot of detail to do. That's a tradition with a very tight bottleneck, right? Almost nobody can do that. But it's out there. And I know people that can do it. I can't do it, just full transparency. But I wrote my dissertation partly about people that can, and because I was fascinated. I was like, what do you do? What's it like? And they were like, it's like this. And most of my field research was me talking with cool people and just being like, whoa, wow, cool, you know. And I constructed a subject that made me able to just interview my friends for my dissertation research, which is very nice. So that exists. But that's a beginner instruction that is not a beginner instruction. Mm-hmm. But even in modern yoga and meditation, that has gotten so user-friendly, still the instruction, you know, sit comfortable and close your eyes. Okay, well, let's focus on justice and trauma. Lots of people can't be comfortable ever, pretty much. And closing the eyes feels dangerous. So my style of instruction, and really the main practice we're going to talk about around trauma sensitivity, is language, how you use language. Now I would say things like, find a posture that's as easeful as is available in this moment for your body. Begin with the eyes open and just see where your attention wants to rest that feels the most at ease and rest. And if the main thing you're aware of is unrest. See if you can sense what is the less unrestful that you have. In other words, what's the most pleasurable thing you have access to, even if that thing is still painful? Right? If you can dial it down a little bit by like staring out the window, stare out the window, you know, or keep moving. Or don't try to calm your thoughts, like a million things. Right? But the urge is the same. Can you find the conditions under which your system can settle even a little bit? And that pathway, that's the main practice. You follow that all the way, it goes all the way to the white light and the clear mind. And you just keep doing that endlessly, you know? And advanced meditation practice looks something like, okay, I'm resting in states of kind of clarity and consistent attention and kind of blissful, energetic feelings for, you know, 20, 30 minutes at a time. You might be like, I'll take it, right? But maybe you get really into practice and you're on retreat and you're with a precise teacher. You go and you report your experience and they would say, is the perception of the center of the sphere growing more distinct or staying vague? You go back to your hut, meditate for another few days. Oh, if I orient toward the center of the sphere of perception, it becomes more distinct. You go back to the teacher. The teacher would say, okay, how long does it stay distinct for? A couple minutes and it flickers out. Like, okay, so your main practice is to focus on that until it stabilizes. You go back, you're like, oh, it stays for a long time and it gets more solidified. At some point, the teacher's like, oh, switch the object of your meditation from the breath or the mantra or whatever to the perception of stability or whatever, a million things, right? So like, there's details, but they are the same thing. Like, what's the pathway toward more stability? A beautiful quote from the Taoist traditions in China. Tao is sometimes called the water course way. And it's that because water is fluid and constantly moving, but it is in intimate relationship with gravity, and it always finds the lowest path, and it finds whatever pathway it can. It'll go backwards, it'll go around things, it'll even go up in strange ways, right? If that's the clearest pathway into gravity. Yeah? Why does it do that? What is it doing? Right? It's actually responding to a force that's drawing it toward rest. If we think of gravity as like, if you just keep going down, at some point you land. You know, it's like, oh, that's the thing. That's the thing. There's a beautiful Buddhist text that says, talking about like find the comfortable posture. The Buddha says, there was a man who was walking along quickly, but then it occurred to him, walking along quickly is kind of stressful. What if I just stand? So he stands. He says, standing, it's more comfortable. But it's still kind of stressful. What if I were to sit down? So he sits down. It's very, very comfortable. But actually, sitting down is a little stressful. What if I were to lie down? And he lies down. Right? And the idea is that like you're just following that impulse toward landing. Mm-hmm. Yeah? And so then part of what you're doing here actually is you're discerning that the negativity bias, or what we'll call in organic intelligence, the red habit, basically, is that I have learned to always stay close to what's wrong, even when it's not immediately threatening to me. But doing that keeps a degree of tension in my system, right? Because I'm activated. I'm scared. I'm angry. So I'm always a little activated. I'm not at rest. So then the instruction, go toward rest. Go toward more stability. It's like, I have to actually let go of fixating on what's wrong in order to do that. And like, if I turn away from just like being annoyed by that sound, and I just tune into how lovely the walls are and how nice you people seem, the sound is still there. But my system goes, I hadn't noticed. I was all messed up around some other thing. Mm-hmm. My system comes toward rest. Deactivates. Any questions on this realm? Cool. So a little practice. And most of what we'll do here is, you know, I'll talk a bunch and then we'll do a little something. And we'll do some longer practices. We'll do a little longer practice in the middle of the day as well. But here's a practice. You've been sitting for a while. You might have a little urge to move. You might have been containing the urge to move because you're well-trained, you know, civilized yogis, but like, stop it. Don't do it yet, but here's what we'll do. I'm going to encourage you we'll take a few minutes to do whatever your body wants. So you might stand up, you might jump around, you might stretch, do some postures, like move around the room, you might walk, you might shake, you might lie down, you might put, you know, you have a vocabulary. Yoga is a vocabulary, you know, and whatever else you've done is a vocabulary. And the instruction, this is partly how I teach yoga right now in the sadhana courses that I do. The instruction is to do whatever you want. Really, no boundaries other than like don't hurt anybody. And what you're following is basically what could I do that would decrease the sense of the unpleasant and increase the sense of the pleasant. So like you might go toward less activity or more. You might go in any direction, but you're going to follow the scent of ease and joyfulness. Yeah? And you're going to move around a little bit because we've been sitting for an hour and a half or so. Yeah? So let's take 5 minutes, do anything you want, and it's really a practice. Follow the music.
Stay in the room?
Not necessarily.